I'm Joe.
And I'm Allison.
And I'm Colladen.
Hello, hi, and how are you? Thank you so much for joining me for another Tangent episode of Referential. I am your host, Colladen Noss. I was recently asked by two new friends, Joe and Allison, to guest on their podcast, Queer Cinema Catch-Up, and talk about one of my absolute favorite movies. 2001's Josie and the Pussycats. We had such a fun conversation that I couldn't resist asking them to give me the episode to play around with and to add to my own feed. So you are listening in to Colladen's version of the episode. Though I really recommend that you look up Queer Cinema Catch-Up wherever you get your podcasts. They're also on Instagram at queer_cinema_catch-up. They offer a really fresh and often unexpected perspective on things, and it really feels like you're sitting in with two of your oldest friends having the best conversation about some of your favorite movies from before and from now. And that's it from me. I hope you enjoyed this episode about what I think is top five, at least, classic movies of all time. And I will check back with you here at the end.
Let's go! Let's go! Go! Go!
Talking about that movie, maybe not as a possible QCC movie, but you've mentioned it to me several times.
I had just seen it with my friends. Remember, I went over for a movie night and we watched Josie. Oh. I saw it for the first time within the last year.
That was the first time you'd ever seen it.
I've never seen it before.
Whoa.
We'll get into it, but just the marketing around the movie was a lot different than the movie that I actually saw. Once I found out Parker Posey was in it, I was like, game over. I need to see this movie immediately. Immediately.
Joe really likes Parker Posey.
I love Parker Posey.
I don't know a better person.
How could you not?
Yeah.
And then Allison had actually seen the movie.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it scratched that part of my brain where I'm like, I remember seeing this in theaters as a kid. And I didn't actually remember a lot of the plot, but what I did remember was one of climactic moment before they go up on stage where they're in the bowels of the stadium and the villains are trying to be villains and then they get arrested.
Strangely, you remembered the end.
Yeah, but nothing else. And then I remembered their costumes, probably because they were attractive to me as like a 13-year-old girl. Ooh, I want to wear glitter. And they're also really pretty.
For me, this is like a childhood film. It was like a television film. That's when I first encountered it. But before that, I grew up reading Archie comics, which is like part of this world. So like I knew Josie and the Pussycats. And then I remember it popped up and like something about it, just one of those films that I watched halfway through. And then I was like, oh, this is the best thing I've ever seen in my life. I must watch the full thing. And then it's just become one of like my totem movies. I put it up there with Romy and Michelle.
I invented Post-its.
Yes.
Absolutely. Like,
oh my gosh.
It's on like the Mount Rushmore for me. Movies, like this is one of them.
Was the Mount Rushmore situations.
It'll be like Josie from Josie and the Pussycats. It would be Viola Davis. Who else would be in there?
Romy and Michelle, as you already mentioned.
Yeah, Romy and Michelle. And then just like another face of Lisa Kudrow, just for Valerie Cherish this time. We got to have Valerie.
Oh my gosh. What's that show called?
The Comeback.
The Comeback.
I that hear that's hilarious. So great.
It's really good.
I've never seen it.
Oh my God. Okay. Just, okay. Put that on. Write that down right now.
Yeah. We'll need to take time to watch
just
it.
Just get to it.
I'm going to write it down.
And before we get too deep into it, we mentioned your like background a little bit, but did we mention you have a podcast also, Referential?
Oh, yes. What the heck?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Describe what you talk about on that podcast.
Please. So the quick line that I came up with is that Referential is a podcast where we have serious conversations about frivolous things. Yeah, we're working on the brand. So basically, it's just a chance for me to real deep dive and do some of the work that I naturally do as a researcher.
With that in mind, with Referential and what you cover on that podcast, I feel like Josie the Pussycats fits perfectly into this idea of, if you'd say, like a frivolous movie and contextualizing it a bit more. I'm really excited
to
dive
sort of like
that.
Seemingly frivolous, but then it's the way it was responded to at the time of its release and what it has to say perhaps is a bit a lot of fodder for conversation.
And also I think what it means, I'd say, today is also really important. I think it's always really fun, I find, delving into sort of these older properties that we think we know very well and actually looking at them in the context of, okay, what does it mean today? How is it working today? What does it say about where it came from and when it came from?
Absolutely.
Josie will give us like a huge chance to talk about that. I mean, goodness, this movie is stuffed.
Before we get too deep into it, one of my favorite things is when Allison does her own version of the plot. Would you want to, doesn't have to be 100% right. And then we'll read the synopsis afterwards.
Okay, just watch her only describe the last 10 minutes, because that's still the only thing you remember.
Still just percolating it in my childhood brain.
The movie starts with Parker Posey yelling, and then Alan Cumming was...
I I would say there's sort of two tracks to this movie. One track, you are watching a villainous manager slash agent kill pop stars that are catching onto his scheme, which is to find excellent musical talent, bring them aboard, make them very famous, and infuse their music with subliminal, although maybe it's sub-aural capitalist.
Sub-aural?
Because it's audio. I was, some review I was reading last night was like, technically, it's not subliminal.
And subsonic?
I was like, I guess it's right.
That works. That sounds like a really lame superhero. I hate it. He's like a water creature who's also a sub.
That's my favorite superhero.
I honestly wouldn't Subsonic. Be shocked if I saw that trailer tomorrow.
And the sun Aquaman trailers. Doesn't talk about.
It's phase 7 of the Marvel Universe.
We're phase yes. end now. We're phase yeah. help me. We're phase enough is enough. We're phase a pox on thy house.
This is what trauma looks like.
Yes. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, so we're following our villains played by Alan Cumming and Parker Posey as they try to pluck a new musical act.
The U.S. government.
And the U.S. government as well to manipulate the human population into following certain trends and buying as much as they possibly can. And then on the flip side, we're following a young girl named Josie and her bandmates, whose names I am forgetting.
Val and Mel.
Yes. And they get selected by our villain to realize their punk pop dreams. And it all is great for them, except they're being manipulated as well. And there's some tension among the band as Alan's character tries to make it so that Josie's the front woman of the show, maybe trying to kill off the other two. And from there, who will survive? Who will come out on top? Our evil capitalist moneymakers or the pureness of Josie and her girls?
I'll do a little Wikipedia synopsis.
Okay, go for it.
Josie the Pussycats is a 2001 satirical musical comedy film co-produced by Universal Pictures and Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Written and directed by Harry Alfont and Deborah Kaplan, the film is based on both the Archie comic series and the Hanna-Barbera cartoon of the same name. Filmed entirely in Vancouver, Canada, the film features Rachel Lee Cook as Josie McCoy, Tara Reid as Melody Valentine, Rosario Dawson as Valerie Brown, Gabriel Mann as
Josie's love interest,
Paolo Costanzo as Man. Manager, Missy Pyle as Alexandra Cabot.
He's the lead, as far as I'm concerned.
Put
some respect on Missy's name, okay?
Yeah. Now, come on now.
The true star.
And then I'll list off two other characters. Alan Cumming as Wyatt Frame, the promoter who recruits and manages the young band for Mega Records. And then, of course, our beloved Parker Posey as Fiona, Mega Records CEO, who uses subliminal messages to manipulate teens' spending. But it sounds like we're saying now subsonic messaging.
And then there were some cameos in the beginning. There was a boy band.
Du jour
that dies, which, perhaps.
Mysteriously.
And it had Seth Green. And who else? It had some famous people.
Yeah. Breckin Meyer. Breckin was in... who's Donald Vajon?
Clueless. And he was also in Scrubs.
And then there was one other person, but he doesn't even have a clickable Wikipedia link. Alexander Martins.
He's probably the one that actually did the singing, is what I was like. I was listening to the music and I was like, who's singing?
Yeah, it wasn't... The woman who played Josie was not singing, I believe. It was someone else.
From Letters to...
Cleo. Kay Henry.
She has a great... She has a great voice. But yeah, of course, I mean, the movie starts out with Backdoor Lover, and it's like immediately watching this movie, I was like, I thought this was a kid's movie. What is going on? Way too much for it to be a sin. People use the front door, but that's never been my way. Just cause I slip in backdoor, girl, that doesn't make me hey.
Lying on your bed, staring Did you delve into the advertising for the film at the time? They're aiming for kids, teens, and I was like, oh.
I think that's the reason. I'm pretty sure I saw it in the theaters, and I think our moms took us to see it because of the marketing.
Yeah, I don't know if we're gonna like immediately go into this, but there's also like Scooby-Doo came out around this time too.
Yeah.
With a lot of these, like, with a lot of that, like, are they like Gen X? Are they millennials also?
I think they're probably geriatric millennials. Let's just us.
the whole history with Scooby-Doo. If you look into it, like initially it was going to be like an R-rated, like raunchy sex comedy.
Yeah.
But then it got toned down tremendously.
Yeah, but they were supposed to be like a lesbian
plot
line. Yeah,
Velma and Daphne.
And
it's Josie and the Pussycats came out, I think, a year before Scooby-Doo did. But it's like, this definitely has those elements of it's on the cusp. Like, it's almost like a, looks visually like a preteen movie. Mm-hmm. But then, like, if you like, there's kids movies that are like made with adults like get it. But some of this, I was like, this is really intense. You have DeJour supposedly dies in a plane crash at the beginning.
And I thank God every day I knew the words to Enter Sandman.
They're singing a song called Backdoor Lover. From behind, There's just a lot of raunchy. Yeah.
Come on. That's a jam. Music,
this music in this movie is incredible.
The music was fantastic.
So good.
Okay, so music is written by Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne, partly.
Yes.
It's written, and also produced by Babyface. So, like, heavy hitters. Like, there
no
are,
wonder
like,
it's so good.
Yeah, and I was going to hit a point.
Go for it.
Earlier, you were talking about the style of the film, and I just wanted to note that the directors, Harry Elefant and Deborah Kaplan, who are also the writers, were also the writers and directors for A Very Brady sequel.
I saw
that. And I love those Brady sort of satire parody. They're some of my favorite films. Mm-hmm. And it has that same R-rating sensibility. Can't Hardly Wait as well. I feel like that is like that teen film, marrying those two sensibilities. But like, interesting you mentioned Scooby-Doo, because... God, you just like made my heart weep a little bit, because I keep imagining what that film would have been if it was like part of that legacy of like these old properties that we're making fun of.
Well, I didn't even attach Brady Bunch. Absolutely is in this realm of Josie and the Pussycats. And then Scooby-Doo is also, it's taking all these children shows from like the 70s or 80s. I'm not really sure when Josie was like remaking it for the late 90s, early
2000s. A little side eye.
Scooby-Doo, it made it very kid.
I wonder
kid.
If this has caused this to end, because this movie really has a bite. Like, if you compare it to some Christopher Guest, those films, which are also satires, but those kind of play nicer with the things that they're dealing with. This one feels like it has, I don't want, it's a lot more cynical. Not that I disagree with a lot of it. I think we should, let's just start at the beginning. One, two, three. Did you like it?
Overall, I loved it. There was a point maybe in the middle section where I was like, all right, I'm getting a little burned out on this humor, but then again it picks up towards the end and I get into it.
Yeah.
I think what you were just saying, how it juxtaposing the teen or preteen aesthetic or very loud, very bubblegum with the cutting message, I kind of like that contrast, and so it was really fun for me while I was watching, and the music's fun, I'm enjoying it, I'm laughing, but then I'm like, oh, it has a lot to say too, so I feel like I'm feeding my brain but also just my desire to watch something silly and fun, and I enjoyed it.
How about you?
I love this film. I was afraid sitting down to watch it because it's been a few years since I watched it. And
you remember when's the last time you watched it?
It was like, I think it was like a birthday of mine. It might have been when I was turning 28.
Okay.
Something like
so
that.
So you've watched it, because you mentioned that you'd watched it as a kid.
Yeah, and I'd watched it earlier.
Yeah, I'm always interested to see, because the memory of a kid, and then you rewatch it as an adult. I'm wondering if it appeared more childish to you watching it now, or when you rewatched it when you were 28, or if it was consistent with your memory.
See, that's why I was scared. When I watched it when I was 28, I was like amongst friends who'd never seen it, and they were like, you get that thing where like you're looking over someone's shoulder, and you're just like, oh, are you liking it? You're not like,
I hope
you're not
you
laughing
love it
enough.
Like I do. Yes.
I think we're all the same in that area.
Clap if you have anxiety.
Yeah, and then it was like, and they liked it, liked parts of it, but they didn't love it like I did. So I was like, was I wrong this whole time? So this time, I watched it just the other day. I just sat. I was like, yeah, I'm just going to do it. I really liked it. I was so relieved. I was like, no, I do like this. I think it is good. I do think like there are parts of it that aged a bit weirdly. I'm not mad at that. I like the fact that the jokes that are being made aren't jokes that would be made now. I like that that's like exists, is preserved as like almost a testament of, oh, this is what people found funny at the time.
Time capsule a little bit.
Yeah, but there's a lot of other aspects of it. If you compare it to something else, I don't know, the Adam Sandler lineage of like comedy movies from that same era, it's I still find these jokes funny. Like, there's more to work with here as opposed to. I did want to ask though as well, like just on this note, because this film was panned, like this film was not liked. It was a disaster, which is like it eventually gained some acclaim. What do you feel about that? Why do you think that happened? Aside from just the marketing.
I haven't done as much research. I'd be curious what you both have to say in terms of the market of it. But my understanding is, I think the marketing, it was a matter of expectation. And I think it's like, it had trouble finding an audience. And like, a lot of people go into this movie remembering like maybe reading Archie comics, reading like Josie and the Pussycat comics, and then going to this movie, it puts a spin on it. And I wonder if that's why, because it's not quite a kid's movie, not quite an adult movie, if it couldn't find the audience. And then also the fact that maybe it appears a lot different. It's not that it's insincere, but it's very tongue-in-cheek.
Absolutely.
In a way that might rub people the wrong way.
I guess when I was starting to look into this movie, but after we had watched it, I was reading a lot of articles that had come out recently or around the 20-year anniversary mark. And they were positing that back then in the early 2000s, the audiences didn't really understand the message of the movie. And I feel like that seemed a little...
How could you not?
I feel like that's just very obvious. And so I think it's more maybe it's something to do with the bringing up Scooby-Doo and reminding us about how they did cut out that kind of more satirical, raunchy edge to it. I almost wonder if we're now in such a meta time where we're always commenting on everything that's happening. Every piece of culture is analyzed. And so we're much more primed to look at media in that way. And I almost wonder if it just wasn't the right moment for that kind of movie, even if the message was understood. But I don't know, because
I feel like
I just don't know.
I brought it up before, though, in terms of the meta humor. I think it was already there, as we mentioned before, like the movie Scream. Mm. It's already been done. The horror franchise was very meta. But I wonder if it, like kids' movies, if we weren't quite there yet. Because Brady Bunch also is a very meta movie, satirical comedy. Still, I wouldn't describe it as a kids' movie. Like, kids can watch it, but it's definitely
like PG-17, at least.
I kind of agree with you that I think it might be like down to it just being the wrong time for some of the things that it was doing to be received. I went back and I looked on the Wikipedia, just running through some of like the critical reviews. I was like, oh, Ebert hated this film? Compared it to Spice World, which he also hated. I was like, dude, I would not believe that. But then I was like, okay, so it's just misogyny. It must be just misogyny, right?
I think that could be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I read his review. It was very short. You didn't even give me a reason beyond these are dumb girls.
What did he say in the review?
It's like this long.
Was he like, this movie was not as good as Spice World, which I also hated?
No, he was like, it's as bad as Spice World, the worst movie ever created.
Spice World was also a satirical comedy.
I think it's just like he doesn't like it when women make jokes.
Maybe not. Yeah, taking it very
women
much, like,
aren't funny.
I mean, I would say maybe he was taking it at face value. But again, like the messaging in this movie feels to be very direct. It's not implied. It's all there on the screen for you to see.
Yeah. Like the only thing come down to is that just like they weren't primed because they weren't willing to take the humor coming from the perspective of this film. And let's not erase the fact, a rarity for the time. There's a woman writer, there's a woman director.
Mm-hmm.
And and you can see that perspective, I think, in the film. It just
absolutely.
And that's not to say that it doesn't like slip up. There's one black character in the film. And
yes.
A lot of the things that happen to her feel like racially coded.
I think so.
Yeah, but like at the same time, they don't really touch that story and she doesn't really have a personality. And it's obviously that's like a thing that I wish the film did better. But
it was like small accents in certain scenes where they hinted at why maybe Alan Cumming's character was specifically trying to cut her out the most of all.
Yeah, and it's like really interesting because all the characters are like, they're not full characters, they're stereotypes. Melody is like the dumb blonde. It's the Powerpuff Girls. It's literally the Powerpuff Girls, aren't they?
Yeah.
Right? But then you had Valerie and it seemed like they wanted to do a thing with the idea of the angry black woman. Which, like, okay, I wish they did. I wish they actually took it there to actually examine that. Yeah, this movie is so much about perception and representation, and that feels like such a gap. And yeah, I just think it's misogyny. I think it's like not wanting to take humor from women's. I think it's the same thing that happened with Hannah Gadsby. You know, a humor from someone who was femme presenting at the time is just like something that like cis men just would not accept.
You mean Hannah's special made such a splash, and then?
Well, then also the reaction. So it's like, oh, this isn't a joke. This is a lecture. You know, this isn't a comedy special. Like something about that reminds me of what's happening. Yeah, this isn't comedy or I don't want to take it as.
Yeah.
I just don't want to take it in. It's a rejection of it.
Yeah. Instead of saying, oh, this is a different way of approaching comedy. It's that's not actually comedy at all.
It's not coming from a masculine perspective. I don't care. As I think where it was. There's a lot of the, and I think it also had like, you were mentioning the comic book aspect. It's a kid's comic book. Archie Comics. I read when I was like single digits, and that's what I knew Josie and genuinely that's what I knew like Josie and the Pussycats. And so I think people like don't respect that, and so when this movie was coming out they were like, well, whatever, little did they know Riverdale was on its way.
I keep thinking about that and realizing how they're like, they were onto something, because it's gonna be a cultural
giant universe
show.
Yeah,
and this is like the Archie movie brand and like cinema brand. It's like strange versions of like our characters.
What a strange world. Also too, this movie not being successful, it's like you have Rachel Lee Cook, who was coming off like She's All That, I'm pretty sure. She was like a huge teen movie star. Tara Reid was in American Pie, which is like a huge like sex comedy. And then Rosario Dawson, I know she would go on to be in Rent and become more, I feel like she became bigger after this movie.
She was like bubbling.
I'm not like too familiar with her filmography before this point, but it's like, when I was watching the movie with Allison, I really noticed it this time around with Rosario. It's every time we would cut to her, all she was limited to do was like pouting. And there seems to be more below the surface, but they never quite commit to it, which is, it just sucks. Like, why? watch. It's like every time we like cut to her, it's like she's like kind of cynical and like uncertain, but we don't get enough of her character to really explore.
No, there's no character. It's a face. It's like a slight face at the edge of a scene sometimes.
Yeah. Wish they could have explored this so much more. I think it would have made for a much stronger movie.
I also agree because I think the way that ends up positioning sort of the core break in the band, which is so crucial to the final stretch of the movie, because they haven't spent a lot of time developing her character going just a little bit deeper, it seems like she's mostly upset that she's not going to be the star.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is kind of blunts the message of the movie, whereas, you know, they're the artists. They're supposed to be in this for their friendship and their pure love of music. But then that kind of messes with that message a little bit, because it seems like she's just angry that she doesn't get to be on in the public's mind as the best one of the group.
Yeah. She somehow turned into Effie in the end.
Effie, we all got paid.
And it's like, that's incorrect, you know? So you said something earlier when you were doing the synopsis, which I do want to hit on as well. The manager's job is to come in and find people who made good music and then make them famous to use them. I don't think they need to be good at
music. You're right. Actually, he never even listened to their songs.
No, he just did the CD, which I thought was like one of my favorite parts of the film. When he was describing them, I think, to Fiona for the first time, I wrote down the line, I think three Christina Aguilera's, but one tan one. I think TLC with two white chicks. Or Hole. Those are like so three very different musical things. There's like a lack of respect for the actual craft of the musician.
Mm-hmm.
I also thought, okay, so this is something I thought of when watching the film, when I was thinking about the pop musical, all of it. How do you think this movie feels about pop music?
I guess.
But I wouldn't even, it's, okay, there's something about this vibe where like it doesn't come off as like pop music to me. I mean, you've written down like pop punk music. But I don't think
it was before pop punk, wasn't it?
Right. It's
that
before it, yeah. But you're like, Britney Spears is like the biggest, like Christina Aguilera, they're going head to head. They're like, back they are the boys. Biggest pop stars.
They were
stars.
The girls. Yeah.
And then we also are coming off of the Spice Girls. We didn't really have like girl groups at this point. Am I wrong in saying that? Like, I
don't. Destiny's Child was around that era.
Oh, that's true.
You know?
But
it was also like Dream, you know? It was like those early kind of like.
I'm not as familiar with that group, but like an all girl group band playing their own instruments. Like, heading pop culture, like I can't think of a band.
The thing is that I mean, looking at the actual people they got to make the music, it's more of an indie music vibe, wasn't it?
That's what I would say too. It's like pop indie punk to me.
I wrote that down. This movie and the music of the movie kind of preceded the pop punk movement that was coming on. Apple was just about to come in, and that kind of kills the joke of it, which is this is meant to be kind of like a punk band, like a punk band being a vehicle for commercial and pop music. But then that actually happened in culture right when the movie was coming out.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like such an interesting irony that happened there.
It kind of shows how smart this movie is because it almost anticipated how the way art or music could work as sort of counter-revolutionary or pushing you to think outside of the norms. Instead, it was like, no, we're going to take that aesthetic and that way of creating music, and we're going to also use it to pedal to the mainstream as well. And it's going to work.
This is what those kids think they're hearing on those headsets. And this is what they're really hearing.
Conform. Free will is overrated. Jump on the bandwagon.
Hey, that voice. I know that voice.
It's Mr. Movie Phone.
Yes.
He does all our subliminal tracks.
Yeah, but Brett, I guess like I'm really interested in your question. What is this movie like? How does it feel about pop music? And I think we dip more into the genre of music than answering that question. And when I'm watching the movie, like it like didn't really cross my mind. And I honestly like my answer is I don't know. I'd be curious what you'd say.
So compare it to something like the Lady Gaga's A Star Is Born, where pop music is not respected in that film. I feel that's my perspective. I feel like pop music is a joke. It's like people who make pop music, it's nothing. It's not a thing that's worthy of respect. There's rockism in it. And I think it's weary of it. I think it's almost not blaming the actual music. It's just blaming the industry. I think the critique
focused on the industry, I'd say, than the music genre itself.
I think it's kind of trying to say that, especially with the joke at the end about how now we're going to do it in movies, too.
Yeah.
They're kind of they're trying to draw a distinction between art and then the way business or our cultural forces will come in and corrupt or use art to their own purposes, and perhaps no artist can really purely do anything in the world that we live in, society that we live in, but they're not necessarily looking down on the artistic process, whether it's pop or something else.
No,
it's really sympathetic to like the people.
Because even look into, you have Parker Posey and Alan Cumming are like outright villains. Yes, there's a, there's kind of a bizarre, which hasn't aged so well, characteristics about them where they aren't. They seem to be, which was part of the thing where I felt a little dated.
We changed that now, Would have made it even more wild. I would have truly revealed he has green skin. True weirdos, you know, like they're not human. Yeah. They should be real monsters.
I think that at least should have gone further, I agree.
When they hinted in the movie, because Allison hadn't seen it in a while, when Parker Posey like slipped into a lisp.
So pretty and popular.
I was like, oh my God, I forgot about this storyline. I was like, I cannot remember if it's just a lisp, but then she pulls out her teeth. I'm like, what is the two different things? Like, you
really misunderstood the assignment. And I was like, oh.
But going back to like how music, like how the movie goes about music, I do feel like it's more focused on the industry. Parker Posey, Alan Cumming are like just straight up villains. And then you even have Carson Daly in this movie. And at the time, like TRL was a huge deal. You have it at MTV, and that's how like music videos became really popular. That's how they entered into the zeitgeist, or maybe they're already like in the zeitgeist, is they play on TRL. Like the most successful music videos would just repeat all day. And Carson Daly headed that. And then you even have the scene where the audience would usually sit on TRL is now filled with cutout boards of really popular musicians of the time, pop girlies. Like you have Christina Aguilera, you have Gwen Stefani was up there. I love Gwen Stefani.
What's his name? The pirate man.
Oh, yes, Johnny Depp was up there. I was confused by that. And then there was another actor, Matt Damon was up there too, who is not a singer.
Yeah.
I'd say even less so than Johnny Depp. Then you also have Ricky Martin was up there too. I think there were a few other people mixed in there.
Do you remember there was like that era like of late TRL where it was like they just bring movie stars on randomly, and I'm just like, it just feel like, why are you here?
That is strange. Yeah. I also didn't watch like too much MTV at that time, so I wasn't very familiar with it. But like now, like looking back, I'm very familiar with those people. But look at like Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, Ricky Martin. These are all artists who, like, yes, they made music, but they were so, especially, I mean, look at Britney Spears now, trapped by the industry.
And exploited.
And her image, like, to look at her now, is just kind of...
It takes on such a different tone when you know the actual backstory, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Just, I mean, it's like satirical about the music industry, but the music industry, it can be a very dangerous
place. Joke in the beginning is it's so dark, they're actually killing people that are catching on, but they are kind of actually killing. People who,
In the notes I sent to you guys, I made a joke. I was like, oh, Fiona is Lou Pearlman, the guy that put together Backstreet Boys and NSYNC. I was like, I wonder if, is this like that kind of thing where everybody knew? It was like a Weinstein. You all knew what was going on, and then you just put it on screen.
And maybe why it didn't do so well, because people were angry that they were pointing out the truth. No, we're supposed to keep this hidden and not talk about it.
Leads me to, like, how did this movie get, I'm happy it did, but like, how did it get made if it was so cynical about the music industry? Like the music we're talking about, it's like more like pop punk indie, I would describe, but then the visuals is very pop. It's very pop.
So that's why I brought up like Avril Lavigne, because I was like, I feel like that's what happened, and then suddenly it became this, you know what I mean? So I feel like I get a weird dissonance watching it. I'm just like, I feel like this is completely correct but came out at the wrong time.
Absolutely.
When you say that though, when Avril Lavigne first entered the scene, she was, what's the word, like she was much more on like it was pop music, but like very tomboy pop, like punk leaning. And then her following album, I think her first album was like Let Go, and then she had Under the Skin, and those two albums are very similar. But then her third album, that's the one that had like Girlfriend on it, and she has like blonde hair with like pink stripes, and it was becoming very like pop music. It was like very strange to see. Like,
I was gonna say, I wonder if what you're describing is like, I wonder if that's just because when they were imagining this, they were like, let's put them basically in like the costume that Christina would wear, or that Britney would wear at this time, you know?
But visually,
but like, and then that eventually became what actually happened. When you think of, then we had Kelly Clarkson, and then we had all the other girls that are like basically doing that same thing.
What I found interesting about this movie though, it's, I feel like Josie the Pussycats were introduced, the music that they first sing in the beginning, it's like three. Is that the one? Is that the first one they sing?
I don't know.
It's three little words.
Three little words.
Not my favorite song on the soundtrack.
I thought it was like catchy, but it has like a pop punk indie vibe to it. But what's interesting, this movie, as the music industry like becomes involved, I feel like they're never, yes, their image, they go through like a whole makeover process. But what's interesting is their music doesn't really change.
Yeah,
I feel like it stays consistent throughout the whole movie. So that's kind of where I'm like, it's a little confusing, because you have them change visually, but then they kind of stay true to their sound. Yes, Parker Posey is slipping in subsonic messages
to make her come off as the most beautiful, successful woman in the
Everybody
world.
Everybody loves Fiona.
Yeah, it's like
I know we said it's problematic, but it was also iconic, and I cannot do it.
Parker, should you know wrong? Yeah, I wrote down some of the other songs. Like, there's the song like "You're a Star," which plays during the makeover scene, which again sounds like the song that we heard in the beginning. And then we have "Pretend to Be Nice," which is like the that's like the quote unquote like banger song where we see them literally like climbing the charts to the top.
Oh yeah, that was
also
hilarious.
Sounds it, like and then you have. Like Spin Around, which is their final performance at the end. Like all these songs, like I can imagine them being on like one CD. Like
I mean, interestingly, that CD, the soundtrack, went gold in America.
Yeah, I saw that it did really well.
It was successful. It was successful. It did go gold. So it's
like, yeah. How was that successful? The movie was not.
I mean, because the music is good. I guess when the music is good, it might just catch on radio or something. But like, I think what you were saying, I had an idea that came in my head when you were talking about that. Well, I wonder if like, the fact that the music didn't actually change is kind of just like reflecting the idea that like the industry is going to take advantage. However, either way,
I think so.
Like they're still going to stick a Target poster on you, even if you're just doing what you want to do. But that's what I would guess.
Yeah, that kind of makes me think about how artists always think, oh, this is something new. I'm saying something new and pushing back against society. This will change everything. This, you know, I have a voice. And then our society always finds a way to kind of bring that back into its own purposes, I guess.
Also, this was coming right before the pop girls that you were just talking about early, the Christina, were going about to go enter their like mature phase. How do you think that sort of reacts to the way that, I guess, like, they are being presented as women?
You mean in the sense that it's kind of a shift from, you know, the girls of pop to now they're entering their more mature, womanly crossover? Like, we're crossing over from what they were to what they'll be?
I guess so. Because Josie and the Pussycat rebelled by, like, fighting the bosses. You know what I mean? But, like, then in real life, what happened was that, like, Brittany and Christina ended up getting more sexual as a way to try and affirm their maturity. But, like, in the movie, that point that you were also making, Joe, about, like, their outfits, they were already sexualized a lot more than, like, what the pop girls were wearing during Come On Over and during, not a lot more, but they were. Like, Josie was, like, had her,
yeah,
her dress cut down to her. Yeah. Like, oh, it is a bit more.
Because, I'd be curious to go back and watch the movie, but it never really crossed my mind. Yes, they were wearing very revealing outfits in this movie, but I would be curious to like go back and look at how the beginning of the movie starts out, because I just feel like they go through a makeover, but like visually
they didn't change that much.
But maybe they're like speaking to like Brittany and Christina especially, they started out like they had more like innocent phases. I mean, Christina, there was a lot of subtext with Genie in a Bottle, and she was very sexualized.
I feel like, Hit Me Baby One More Time, was that her first music video or no?
Hit Me Baby One More Time. Yeah. Yes, very.
I mean, that's extremely sexual.
But it's like,
but in an innocent
tongue
way.
In cheek. It's like innuendo. It went from innuendo to like text.
Get over. That makes sense. Okay.
Where you have, and then you have Christina Aguilera goes from Christina Aguilera, Genie in the Bottle, is the same thing where it's like, rub me the right way. It's all like from Texas there. But then she like literally goes to Xtina. Which is, she has become, like, she's owning her sexuality.
You just need to kind of think about how one thing about this movie, honestly, yes, their outfits are revealing, but I didn't really think it leaned too heavily on their sexualization, and even like the romance plot was very PG, and that was felt like the most little kid element of the movie.
And very shoehorned.
Kind of didn't fit. And then at the same time, obviously, because it's a satire, it's got to kind of tell you, make its point in a way that is comical and digestible, I guess. But the fact that this music is telling them things like go out and buy earrings, or it was very, the actual messages, it was very, how do I explain this?
Can I take a crack?
Yes, please.
Is it that the messages in real life ended up selling us things through sexuality? And the messages in the movie had like,
go ahead. Sorry, go for it. But I was just saying, it's kind of like more basic consumerism.
Should I jump in also?
Like, this is a metaphor for consumerism, period. But yeah.
Well, for me, like, yes, it's a metaphor for consumerism. The pop music industry, if we look at those examples that they're calling on us to draw, ended up using sexuality from that point on that the movie's trying to represent onwards to be part of that consumerist push. We were selling people things like, I think of somebody to Paris Hilton.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hilton selling the big, was it like the Hardee's burger or washing the car? Like that became the same.
Totally.
But then this film instead is very, it's almost like neutered in the way that the MCU is. I hate using that word. It's the wrong word, but that's what I'm trying to get at.
Watered down.
Yeah. It's not highly sexual. It's not highly sexual. It's just that we have women, that every woman that is not wearing a bra, you know?
Yeah, they're
and
all
I feel
very,
like a
yeah.
choice that was made. You know,
yeah.
like everybody's not being sexual, but they're dressed in Speedos and a bikini. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like a weird double messaging, which I kind of feel like in many ways, a reflection of that innuendo and that music. You know what I mean?
I think that's right.
Like they just
I think
made
that's
it
right.
visual.
I think that's so right. And that is interesting to think about how just after this, the music would lean on sexualization to sell. And whereas in this movie,
he really
it was
cares
more,
about this guy.
Yeah.
I do. I'm so passionate. But yeah, I find that really interesting.
Could you quickly, could you kind of summarize what just transpired right now? Because I got lost.
The movie is not selling sex, but everybody's dressed sexy. In real life, these pop girls who were doing the same thing that they were doing ended up actually selling sexy because they found out that was effective. And that's something that the movie didn't really predict, but it touched on.
That was perfect. Yeah. That was great.
Got it.
Because this came out in 2001. So it was being filmed in 2000, 2001. Like all of this is literally like Christina
happening
and
so quickly.
Brittany are like literally going through this as the movie's being filmed. So
yeah.
maybe because it came out as it's happening.
Right.
It's like crazy. Like only can we watch it currently, can we like appreciate like
what it was doing.
This movie is what it was doing. And it's just a shame that it got kind of pushed aside because of especially like misogyny, like just the like not able to appreciate.
I feel like the idea that the message wasn't understood to me seems like too, it makes audiences seem dumb or people seem dumb. And I feel like the message was clear. But then I'm kind of what you're just saying about how it was all happening right then. It's kind of hard to have your finger on the pulse or analyze the moment until you're a little bit removed from it. And so maybe it wasn't that it was understood, but people didn't see how relevant it was at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm bringing this up. This is a dangerous thing to bring up. I'm very passionate about it too, especially just by like music biopics. This is not a music biopic movie. These are not real characters, but like music biopics are being made now with not enough like time passing to really be able to reflect on what happens. And Back to Black came out, the music biopic about Amy Winehouse's life, because if not enough time has passed to like really have a reflection on it, you need time like pass to really like digest things. So this is, I feel like this is totally out of left field, but I do think of like, you need time to pass to really be able to appreciate and satirize.
But it's doing. You need to actually sit with it, marinate.
Because even we brought up the Brady Bunch. That was that show came out in the 70s, and I believe that the Brady Bunch, I could be wrong, but the original TV show became very successful because it started playing on reruns so often.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like Nick at Night, and so like not only did people in the 70s who watched it at the time enjoyed it, but it's like people in the 80s watched the reruns. People like us in the 90s, we were watching it, and then so by the time that the Brady Bunch movie comes out in the mid to late 90s, it has spanned generations, and enough time has passed since the original show came out where people can understand what it's making fun of.
On that point, for me, I feel like there is a cult following for this film. Like we're talking about, like it was really kind of disrespected when it came out, and then over time it gained an appreciation. I do feel like even though with this cult status, there is still like this energy of people not wanting to look at it in a way. And that I would put down to the fact that it's a movie, it's like a movie for girls. You know what I mean? It seems like that's the thing. I think that's the perception, is that a lot of people don't want to sit with it seriously.
I remember I like saw pictures of Josie and the Pussycats as I was like a kid at the time, and I remember seeing like being really excited and wanting to see it, but because it was so pink, because it started all women, I like didn't vocalize that I wanted to see it. I just kind of quietly wished like see it, but then I never saw it until I was an adult.
I get that.
Maybe you could connect to the like questions of masculinity, maybe questions of like my at the time like not like being really confused about my sexuality, like tying all that in of like why this would have been a perfect movie for me to see as a kid, but also because it was perfect, it was why I was really afraid to watch it.
That's a great point.
And then too, I'd be curious to hear, you said you watched it and you showed it to friends who had never seen it before, and it wasn't, you were kind of disappointed because they didn't receive it in the same way that you received it. And my question is, it because you saw it as a kid and you like loved it so much, or is it Like, even if you hadn't seen it as a kid and saw it as an adult, would you have loved it as much, do you think?
There's something about this film that really connects to my sensibility and my sense of humor. It's kind of like a joke in a minute, but then also this kind of absurdist hyper-reality, this kind of critique of the mundane, you know, of every day, or the things that you think of as you don't think about too intensely or deeply, right? Film operates on all those levels. It's operating on so many levels. Every time you watch it, you can think of it from a different perspective. I love things like that. And that's like everything I love now has that aspect about it. So I think, I mean, I don't know, maybe like it's partly shaped a lot of my identity, maybe, you know, or aspects of my identity, because I like this thing. So I went to something else similar to it that I liked. And then I'm now here at this part of the journey. Right. This is a film that was made by like really clever people and really funny people.
It's a very clever movie.
Yeah. And I feel like I'm good with liking it. You know what I mean? Yes, I will claim this film. Like I said, this will be on my Mount Rushmore. And I can walk proudly.
I love that. Yeah. I love the
you
image.
Enjoy your Citizen Kane bullshit. Correct. I don't give a fuck about that.
I always prefer movies that are smart and funny, but also just fun. Mm. And I feel like this movie is that.
I'd be curious to hear, Allison, your points on this too, because we've discussed what you like and not like about movies. And there's two types of silly movies. Mm. And we talked about, and I'll draw to Dix the Musical. I never thought I was going to be talking about all these movies on this podcast.
I like it.
Okay, can I just say, I clicked play on that episode and I was like, oh shit, I have 10 minutes before I have to get on this podcast. And then I really wanted to listen to your views on it. So I'm excited.
Dix the Musical is a very silly movie. Allison, I think I can speak for both of us. We love silly movies, but Allison made a really good point on that podcast. How about you say?
I guess just that I prefer when I feel like in Dix the Musical, the actors were very obviously in on the joke and turning every scene into a joke and kind of winking at you. But I much prefer when the characters believe the emotional reality of what's happening and their emotional reactions feel very like earned, even in this silly situation. Mm. And so I feel like with Dix the Musical, I felt that was not there, where it felt kind of like a big joke. But in contrast to Josie the Pussycat, the girls, they definitely care and they're upset that their friendship's falling apart. They're frightened that they're in peril. They want to beat the bad guys. And we know it's a joke, but they don't necessarily know it's a joke. And I kind of appreciate watching films
that way.
Even
the comedic characters are also like seriously in it. You know, Missy Pyle is seriously, she hates Josie. She wants Salad Up. And Parker Posey, I mean,
so pretty and popular.
That was transcendent, you know?
Yes.
Like, that was like such a talent to make someone so ridiculous feel like a real person.
It's
just jokes on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
So it's like really commendable that I think it's like magic. This should have an Oscar.
Yeah.
I feel like that kind of performance, like that is such a serious skill. And she's one of the most underrated actresses ever.
She is.
Let's not start on this.
Yeah. She'll get her time to shine. She'll be in White Lotus season 3.
Oh, yes.
She's here to stay. But I bring up Dix the Musical and Josie the Pussycat, comparing and contrasting the two. And also, they're both silly movies, but I feel like where Dix the Musical was just everyone was like being silly. And everyone like felt like they were very aware that they were in a movie.
Mm.
There was like no like any real like emotional core to any of them. I feel like Josie and the Pussycats was a silly movie, but had the emotional resonance with the main characters. Tara Reid, not so much. But Josie, Rachel Leigh Cook, and Valerie Rosario Dawson, who it did not utilize as successfully, but I feel like there was like definitely truth to their emotional connection. Is it not to say like, Dix the Musical wasn't enjoyable, but it's not something that I really want to go back and rewatch. Whereas like Josie, I feel like
I struggled with it too. Yeah, no, I struggled with it too. And I like Josh and Aaron, who I think wrote it and produced it.
I think so.
I enjoyed them. I listened to like their work on podcasts and all that, but I did struggle with it. I feel like, I think a lot of it, what Allison, you were describing, that is like a level of sense of self-awareness. I love a good meta joke, you know? To me, one of the funniest jokes in the movie is when Josie asks Alexander, why are you here? And then Alexander was like, because I was in the comic book, you know? And I was like, oh, that is like brilliant. But like it operated within the movie. When there's like that level of self-awareness, like everybody's outside of it. Everybody's like sort of, everybody's performing. It felt like you're watching a theater production in a way.
Yeah. Yes. Which, I mean, and Dix was originally a theater production. And so I think if I were in a theater, I might appreciate that more, because then when someone's winking at you, you're in the same space as them, literally.
Yeah.
And there's something about that where then you are brought into it. But in a movie, you're kind of separated by the screen. And so I don't know. It just doesn't work as well for
me. Yeah, I feel like for me, like something like Josie feels like there is a world built. Well, there's something like Dix the Musical. You're watching, like you said, you're watching behind a glass. There's a separation, while like you're more so in it with Josie and the Pussycat.
Yeah. Before we segue to the next thing, can you go back to that Wikipedia page on Josie? This fact I want to read.
I know, I was going to say it earlier. It is crazy.
What is it? That,
the casting, do you want?
You want me to do it?
Oh, yeah, the casting story about who were the other potentials. Yeah. Well, I know this. Good to go.
Maggie Gyllenhaal and Zooey Deschanel both auditioned for the role of Josie. Beyonce.
Aaliyah.
And Lisa Left auditioned for the role of Valerie. And then they said, they specifically said that they didn't cast Beyonce because she was too quiet and shy.
I mean, if you've seen, which is, I guess, a movie that's kind of like this one in some levels, Austin Powers, Goldmember, which she was in. Yeah. I feel like that is, I don't think. Yeah, but it would have been insane if she was in this movie. Could you imagine?
I wonder what would have happened. I feel like if that
her being a supporting character, which is hard for me to imagine.
I'm glad she wasn't in it, but I worry it would have taken her away from the rest of her career. I don't know. Could have set her on a different track.
She didn't mean, I just feel like you'd replace this with that goddamn Pink Panther movie and it'll be fine.
She had her chance for that. But Beyonce would go on to be in Dreamgirls, and I feel like she was pretty good in that movie.
We don't talk about the early Beyonce era of movies. We don't talk about Fighting Temptations.
Cadillac Records.
I feel like that's part of Beyonce trying to be an actress. I feel like when she was like doing things that edge close to weird Austin Powers.
I didn't know that she was in Austin Powers. This is crazy to me.
Beyonce was the co-lead in Austin Powers.
Wild.
That's wild. She was in a Pink Panther movie.
Foxy Cleopatra, was that her name? What was her name in that
Foxy
movie?
Foxy Cleopatra.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, no, Beyonce is like,
she was experimenting. She was trying things out, you know?
What a career. So just Beyonce aside, like Left Eye and Aaliyah, isn't that crazy? The fact that you think about the first scene of the film.
Yes.
And they could have been, maybe that was like a blessing, you know?
I think so.
It would have been too hard.
Yeah. Then people would probably struggle to even watch the film. Yeah. If
Did Aaliyah pass away before the movie was even released? Or did she pass away in 2002?
2002.
It's a really tragic story. Left Eye's story is tragic too. Left Eye, her car like went off the road. She died in a car crash. Is that right?
I think so.
And then
for some reason I had an airplane in my head as well.
I think she was a car crash.
But you said
Aaliyah was filming a music video. And on her flight back to the music video, her plane crashed. That's how she passed away.
Yeah.
This movie, the du jour boy band like dies in an airplane crash. It's horrific. And also the movie comes out before 9/11 also probably. So I wonder if that has to do something with.
Maybe.
It came out before 9/11. It was like, it was August. It was like mid-August. So like a few weeks beforehand, I think.
Oh, probably got overshadowed that probably. And then probably limited, because a lot of movies become successful through DVD sales. And it's this movie starts with a plane crash.
It fucked over Mariah Carey's Glitter. Glitter, put that on the list of possibilities.
I haven't seen it.
It's very bad. It's so bad.
I want to give you a zero.
But the soundtrack is great.
Okay, that was going to be
then I'm in, you know?
The music is great, but like every other part of it, it's like a Lifetime movie. It is so bad. Let's not get into that. The other thing, when I was doing the reading, is they were talking about how like the CD stores in this film, and the film came out, and that same year the iPad came out. The iPod came out.
Yeah. Okay, I like the iPod?
And so that was the death of the CD store. And I just wanted to note that. I wrote down, do you remember CD stores? Weren't they great?
There's like a famous record store near us, Amoeba.
Amoeba.
That's obviously a very rare place to encounter these days. I don't know. Yeah. I was never very knowledgeable about music. I don't know why. But my brother, I feel like he was always going to the CD stores. And I'd be kind of curious about what he would bring home. And I'd kind of examine.
We had a Virgin Mega store when I was growing up. And they had those booths. You ever have? Do you know those booths? I love those.
Those also, where you could listen to music, like would click a button, they'd have different CDs that you could listen to. You could listen to it in the store.
I love that. It was like the store was at the mall, and so whenever my mother would go shopping, I'd be like, I just park there, whatever album has just got released. That is the reason why Brandy's Full Moon was like one of the first albums I bought, is because I heard it.
But Brandy's Full Moon is so good. I only know the single. What's the one where she has the music video? She has the bat, and she's like,
What about us?
Oh my god, it's so fucking good.
I was deep with Brandy. I love Brandy.
She's having a resurgence. She's going to be in an A24 movie. And she was just featured on the Ariana Grande remix of one of the.
Yeah, which I've been playing out. Playing that one out. I love that. I love Brandy. I'm glad she's coming back.
Aaliyah also had like incredible music videos. I don't know if you ever saw the music video. She's in the motorcycle. Like she's like literally stroking down. Like she's like in the exhaust pipe. And I forget what song that was.
More Than a Woman. That should be
More Than a Woman. I love that. Yeah.
Which is the one that was also like a cartoon. I think that one like came after her death, but there was like a motorcycle in that. Is that I Care For You? So Aaliyah's like a gem. If y'all not plugged in on Aaliyah, please go play it.
I need to play some review. My musical knowledge is so lame. I have no knowledge.
It's but the great thing is you, I can, Spotify's I right there. New York is it's always there for you to dive into, which leads me to go back to your point about how we discussed how the music, like sonically, was changing, but the music industry was changing a lot too. Mm-hmm. So is that part of why it's like the iPod's coming out? Like, I feel like the music industry is always changing to a degree, right? Mm-hmm. Especially how we consume it. So you have, you start out with vinyls, you switch to cassettes, you go to CDs, it's all digital.
I will say this was a different kind of slightly maybe, I mean, it's like the early 2000s, right? It's like the new millennium.
Yeah.
I mean, what I was thinking of it is I couldn't get past the fact that like this came out in 2001. So it was being filmed around 2000. Yeah. And that was like a new era. That was like the whole messaging of that time. I wonder if there was just like this energy of taking stock when they were sitting down to write the film, like the idea of, okay, this is what the music industry is now from our perception. Mm. And it's almost like they're just sort of taking stock of it and actually trying to do an assessment of it. And they did a satire as the way, but I mean, you're right, like the music industry is always changing and it got worse.
But we need the audience.
And I think it was getting a lot worse at the time. And I think like we're talking about, we hit on that point earlier, is we made a joke like Fiona is Lou Pearlman, but those were things that were known as to be happening, that there were children, there were youth. Like we talked about Britney and Christina were like 18 and 19 or like 21. And like they released music and became like sex symbols.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with like really vulnerable people. I feel like this is what the film is really about. We have built this industry and this industry is moving in a direction where we are cannibalizing these young people, whether we think we're talented or not. We're just
and
like
then discarding them, you know, when going to the next new shiny person soon as they lose their cachet.
What's something that was changing too is this is right before like social media also. I feel like people still have a hard time being able to be their authentic selves or share like truths with their fans, but it's like
the opportunity to really was there.
Yeah. So now it's, I mean, pop stars, now they can go on like Instagram or they can like post on Twitter. Like they have more, I don't know,
control of a narrative,
have more of a, kind but of, yeah, they can like kind of jump on.
But I kind of feel like then it becomes, if your fans expect emotional, authentic connection to you, that becomes another selling tool. And so it's kind of selling your authenticity or using the real stuff, which maybe isn't real, to then sell your music, but
I mean, how many versions of the tortured poets departments are out there, and how many of them are like being labeled private sessions back behind the tour, right? Like we're selling authenticity. And there's also like that trend. I mean, I don't know where I got this from. I was reading something about the idea of therapy in pop music, like the Ariana, that sort of trend in music is kind of like self-healing in the music in it.
Or even beyond music too. I think culturally we're kind of selling therapy speak and vulnerability in a way.
I mean, that's the way we're selling ourselves now, right? And that's how we're forging connections, because the great hope of social media to connect us ended up being like a bit of a figment of our imagination and maybe a bit of a lie.
Yeah.
Well, like there are benefits to social media that has given these people more control over their lives and their career. And we're also talking about this film being very much a product of its time. This was a snapshot before they got all of that, right?
Yeah.
Right. With this narrative of the music industry having so much control over the artists, which I think is still really true today, especially like financially, and the lack of money an artist can make through streaming is even worse now.
Of course.
But like at that time, it's kind of a scary thing to think about. You have Rachel, Tara, and Rosaria's characters. They don't have control over their image, and they have no outlet to communicate that they're image is being taken advantage of. And I feel like there are more outlets today. If they can actually do that is another question, but it's interesting. It's like the music industry controls you at every level, and there's no way for you to really speak out about it to a wide audience.
Then take that to the meta level, where now we're in a situation where we have these outlets where they can speak on it, but then we have a cultural structure that will cast you in specific roles sometimes when you speak on your identity, where like that ends up being like almost a poison chalice in a way. There's no easy answer.
Because with some artists too, like you're kind of, oh gosh, Alaska's on screen. to go back to like Taylor Swift, and there's almost, it's kind of how it's a double-edged sword, is it's when things happen, you're like, then everyone like expects, anticipates that you need to react to it and respond.
Yeah.
And so it's, I mean, to be most recently, there's been the bomb scare that happened for her concert in Vienna. It's everyone's, she canceled it. And then the public's waiting for her to post something. What's her like thoughts on this? And it's kind of, it sucks, because it's like now you have an obligation to respond to everything that happens.
It's not our responsibility.
It puts this whole new pressure.
Whatever you put out there, right, it becomes a part of what you're selling or the reason people are tuning in. And so then there's an expectation that you're going to keep doing that, which is also a lot of pressure because like our private lives should be our private lives, but you are a public figure and you've kind of made the choice to share what you're going to share. So it is very complicated.
Yeah. I mean, look at Charlie XCX having a huge moment right now. with her album Brat. And
yeah,
she like one of her songs, Girl So Confusing, was released. And it was like heavily implied that it was like about her and Lorde and how they look so similar and how their music sounds the same and nobody can tell them apart. And she feels yeah. like a lot of, like she upset like that people didn't separate the two. And then she literally features Lorde on the like remix of it. And so it seems authentic, but it's also like she's like using it to like promote
packaging authenticity, isn't it?
Yes.
Like,
and I don't know how harsh I want to be about that, because in many ways that sometimes people do that because these artists aren't making money off their music anymore.
Yeah.
And they're actually making money off of becoming a public figure enough who can sell you an ad on Instagram, right?
Totally.
That's how it is. Well, you were mentioning that. You don't need to really talk about it a lot, but I feel like one thing we didn't address is the product placement in this film. And we don't really need to get into it because I feel like there's so much conversation about it that happened. I feel like partly that was like one of the reasons that people stuck on it as to why you shouldn't really like pay attention to it. Some reason they didn't see it as the satire that it obviously was.
Yeah, people didn't seem to know that it wasn't, they thought the brands did pay for inclusion when none of them did. Yeah.
None of them really did. Ultimately, the reason this film isn't like as popular as it did, is it just because this is a critique of consumerism and capitalism?
Yeah.
Point blank. And so the structure just refused to support something that was going to attack it.
I mean,
if that would just what happened.
I feel like that kind of makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, like they have a hotel room that is
Revlon.
Like Target logos everywhere, McDonald's in the shower. Like clearly, like they're making fun of this. But at the same time, just because you're making fun of it, like you're still featuring these brands in the movie. And so you're still like kind of promoting
these brands. They did it in the most ethical way possible. They didn't take any money from them.
I saw some quote, I don't think I pulled it out, but it was something like, they're like, oh, it was interesting to see the different brands' reactions. Target didn't care at all because Target thought, oh, we're so big, it was great. But then another brand was upset.
Yeah.
I forget what the brand was. So it was kind of
Gap made them pull out a seed from the film, I think, is what it was.
Okay.
I could be wrong. They never really made fun of the brands, right? They weren't like stars.
Yeah, I feel like it was like shade, you know? It wasn't. They didn't reach the girls. They just shaded them.
The bigger story is an insult to like consumerism. The album that they're going to make is a product. They're selling these Josie ears to like tune in.
Yeah.
Like, you need to buy this to be able to enjoy this. Kind of insults to the brands, but the brands are so big. They're fine.
They'll be fine. And
they are still fine. Yeah. A lot of the brands in these movies still exist.
Yeah. And this is the one movie I'd like to get a sequel that does not have one. I guess it kind of do have Girls 5 Evo. It's kind of like a sequel.
I've seen an episode
watch.
Here and there. I need to watch
because I just know I would, but I haven't.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet.
Give it a shot. Give it a shot. I love it. I love like anything that's like industry parody. So for me, I love this. I like Pop Stars, Never Stop Pop
So Good.
I like those kinds of films.
Yeah. Have you seen the other two?
I fucking love the other two.
Good.
So good. Just kind of a commentary on like you have Justin Bieber. Well, how does Justin Bieber's siblings feel about fame? And then also like Hacks is another one that we watch a lot.
I like Hacks too. This is a question I did want to have. We're talking about this today because this is a queer film podcast, right?
Yes.
Right.
Where would you locate the queerness in this film? Because it's not anything overt, but I feel like I brought it to you because I was like, I feel like this is a queer film and you accepted it. Why?
Where would we put it on our queer cinema catch-up ranking?
I have one of those. Do we?
Oh, we can go with it right now.
Well, on the radar, on the queer cinema gaydar, right?
Yeah, the queer cinema catch-up radar.
I have an idea, but you...
I mean, hinted to it as a kid where it's like, it's an all-girl group. I feel like making it kind of like pop punk makes it a little more, like it can be appreciated by childhood stereotypes, boy versus girl situation, but it's a very pink movie. Women are heavily featured in it. Like, and I'd say it's kind of like a trope of being gay is like you kind of associate... Like,
it's pink, it's girly.
It's like female centered movies, like definitely appreciated by.
It's like all the boys that didn't go see Barbie.
Exactly. Yeah. Which,
yeah.
Wow. Interesting to bring that movie up too. That's kind of has a.
I do think it is linked.
Except Barbie was a huge commercial, massive success.
I would say it has less claws than this.
Absolutely. And probably why, like Josie really did. It had some claws, it had some bite.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'd rank it high. I think it's a very queer movie, personally.
Yeah.
I think it's that. And I also think if we think about queerness, sure, it's about identity, it's about sexuality.
but it's also about stepping away from what's quote unquote normative and questioning it and saying, is this really the only way to live? Aren't there other ways to live? Mm. Is how we live ethical? Is it how we live? I don't know. I feel like there's a queer stance or a way of looking at the world.
It's queerness is also a sensibility.
And a questioning of what is normative and what is normal. And we don't have to necessarily accept consumerism or capitalism. We can stand askance from it. And maybe being queer and already kind of being outside the norm helps you do that because you're already kind of a step removed.
Yeah.
I love that. I just want to highlight that, like, queerness is about questioning about what is and what isn't normal.
Yeah.
This film is doing that.
Absolutely.
Like, what is and what isn't normal? And look at all those insane things that are actually happening and we're like heightening them. Also, look at them. Look at what we're doing.
And I also think the idea of being a young gay kid, you have a choice to give into, especially like in the early 2000s, like giving into like societal pressures and try to appear like heterosexual or appear how you think like men should behave, like giving into like masculinity. You have this opportunity to try to package yourself to fit into that. And I think to tie it, to really dig into Josie the Pussycats, they're being like forced to package themselves a certain way to then appeal to mass audience. It's like, how can you package yourself to then fit into society? And you can make that choice to give into the pressures to do that, or you can choose to go against it.
Yeah.
I was personally very fortunate that when I chose not to package myself in that way, I was accepted.
It does kind of make me think about in music now, there's a lot of queer voices that are very popular and mainstream, and so that kind of is a hopeful thing. But at the same time, if we think about this movie and how every funk aesthetic, whatever it might be, gets kind of taken and pushed back toward what the machine or our society wants, like how is queerness going to become
utilized?
Like the pink capitalism of it all.
They call it like rainbow capitalism.
Yeah, that's what
like,
rainbow.
When Pride comes around, it's like all the companies are like, oh my gosh.
The pink wash.
Yeah, the rainbows are coming out. Buy our products.
We've reached this era where like authenticity is like, we can't trust it anymore because like it's another product. Now, authenticity, I'm another product.
That motherfucker back there is not real.
I do want to see a sequel where the authenticity is the product of Josie and the Pussycat. Are you dealing with that? That sounds like a great, I'd be there for that movie.
You will have my dollars. All of them. I need them.
Consumerism, that's where I can take my money.
I'm like, I want to see it, I'll pay.
Hey, du jour means a sequel, okay?
Yeah.
So, this is my other question I wanted to say. I wanted to know, what is your favorite? We talked about the product placement now, but what is your favorite product placement moment in the whole thing? There were a lot of good ones.
I don't have a favorite one. It just sticks out of my mind, like the hotel room that have Target everywhere.
Yeah.
Sticks out of my mind.
The Target room?
I think it was zeroing in on New York City and seeing the giant golden arches of McDonald's, because it's not there in real life, but you're like, well, it might as well be. Yeah. Do you have
for
one?
Me, I think I was going to say the McDonald's bathroom.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
And also there was like this little Ronald McDonald doll when she saw him.
It was so creepy.
So I love that. But I think I'm going to go with the Sega Stadium, which I was like, that's just so stupid. But then I was like, no, this would actually be a thing now.
We have Bitcoin
stadiums.
Yeah.
That's true.
A dark joke, but here we are. And then my other question I wanted to ask. All right. So Fiona's evil bunker. She's Elon Musk. This is a yes or no question. Yes?
She could be Elon Musk. I think at the time there was a specific shot. Her office becomes an elevator in a very hilarious scene.
Yes.
And she walks out into like her underground doctor lair. And there's a camera from a distance filming her. And I think they were doing with the movie Network starring Faye Dunaway
about the
industry. And it was very much like giving the tour. She's being this evil villain, kind of like Faye Dunaway is in that movie. Mm-hmm. So I got more of that vibe. But yes, today, definitely, she's like an Elon Musk, I would say.
Oh, my God, that is such a good pull. I did not clock that at all. God, I mean, she just added another layer. They were doing a network thing.
They were doing a network thing.
Brilliant. Give us the goddamn sequel.
Wait, I didn't even connect Alaska, your cat is here, too. How fitting.
We're asking you the pussy for
him. Okay, and then I have... So the final question that I have for you that I wanted to make sure I get in there is... What does du jour mean to you today?
I think we decided du jour means sequel is my...
du jour means sequel.
Thinking of the authenticity thing, how that's the new way of selling, and yet we crave it. We all crave it so intensely.
So du jour is... Oh, authenticity.
Or is authenticity. Because maybe, I think when people are being authentic
a
lot of the times, and then it gets mined for
it.
Call
it, what do you think?
What would you say?
I think du jour means family. I think du jour means trans pride. I think du jour means
the
end of capitalism.
In a positive way. Okay, I like what you're doing with du jour.
We're never going to be taken seriously. Why do that? Why? I feel like we're wrapping up, and I feel like we should take a second. We didn't really talk about Missy Pyle and Alan Cumming being the fucking stars that they are.
Every time Missy Pyle Lizzie Pyle was in the background or doing anything on screen, zero in on her.
Yeah, there's a scene in the bathroom where the girls, Josie Pussycats, were like in the mirror, and I could not take my eyes off. Missy was just looking around, and she just was like, my eyes had really just like, on her.
Stealing.
She wasn't doing, she was just her visual look.
And she said, bring you down the house.
I don't know if you're going to see Bring You Down the House, but she's gold in Bring You Down the House.
Yeah.
And then Alan Cumming is gold in,
he's great in everything.
In Spy Kids.
He's just great in everything.
I like him in The Good Wife. I was a big Good Wife.
I love The Good Wife.
Oh, that's my favorite Alan piece of media, but he's always great every season. He's kind of, I feel like when he's in a movie, you know it's going to be good.
Yeah,
I'm sure he's got a bat. And then you know, and his performance will be
she
was part of the movie.
That moment where she like turned and she's like, you slept with him.
Every time I like cut to her, I was like, why is she in this movie? But I'm like, I'm glad she's in this movie. It was my thought every time I saw her.
She's in the comic. She told
you what. That's the whole book of the two.
She gave you an explanation.
Yeah, but I feel like her, like Missy Pyle and Parker Posey are kind of have the same like vibe.
Energy.
Like, did they ever share a scene together?
Maybe at the end, were they both in the kind of stadium basement?
Okay.
Possibly.
Yeah, I don't know if they do. Maybe they were, like they were in the room together. Yeah.
I don't think they didn't interact.
So they both just have goofy off the wall humor to them. Whereas I feel like Missy can do it with a look, and then Parker can do it with whatever
her voice.
Insane
like,
dialogue.
Her shoulders. Like,
her shoulders. Shoulder acting. Yeah, it's great.
But then, okay, so this movie also, like we were saying, full of jokes. What is your favorite line or joke that you could remember from the film?
I don't remember what was said, but when Josie's figuring it all out and she's in the room with the machine, and then Parker shows up and kind of is, oh, I got you now. Whatever she says then or whatever transpires then, I love. Well, I can't remember what it was.
Honestly, I don't think you'll fit a line either. Let's see. Let's have you close it out. What's your favorite line?
You should kiss my cellulite-free ass after everything I've done for you.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. That was so good.
You really encapsulated Parker Posey.
Thank you. Sorry, I had something on my teeth. She's gone.
When she went, Parker's on the bed. Such a strange scene where she's like trying to be with the girls and she like eats like a single like chip. She's like, oh, I'm so fat. It's
and
like,
then she goes, she's like, how much do you weigh? Oh, 118. I'm 115.
But don't worry, don't look disgusting. You look kind.
Good.
Well, what a great movie.
No, Parker Posey Marathon. I'm just going
to
do that.
Please.
Now.
I didn't want to.
Please.
All right, it's a high recommend. People watch this. Yeah.
Yeah, everyone go watch it. Let us know what your thoughts are.
Yes. I want recommendations because now like I'm in the mood for these kinds of silly films. So I'd say if you like this, watch a Very Brady sequel or a Very Brady, just that series. I think you'd find something there that you like. But then you also mentioned the other two, which I think is also a really good a Hollywood satire. But
You have the other two. You have Girls Five Eva. You have Search Party was another one, kind of like in that vein, just like
Search
just off the wall, like really smart comedy. So yeah, we recommend Josie the Pussycats. We recommend all these like TV shows and Brady Bunch, Brady Sequel, all great.
And we recommend our podcast as well. If you are just joining us on the Queer Cinema Catch-Up feed, then please get to know Referential. Just like to get to know me there. And if you are listening to us on the Referential feed, then please get to know Queer Cinema Catch-Up. Just search for them on their feed and have an explore.
Yeah, we think that there's a lot of shared DNA between our podcasts and that you will enjoy both. So please check them both out.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. We'll have to do this again.
I am so down to do it again.
Yeah.
Yes, I really doubt. I'm really fun. I'm excited. I started this podcast thing because I was like, I want to make friends. So it's nice to actually make
And that's the episode. Thank you so much for listening. You can find Queer Cinema Catch-Up on Instagram at queer_cinema_catch-up. And you can find the podcast everywhere that you get your podcasts. Just search for Queer Cinema Catch-Up. And if you happen to have visited my website recently, www.alsoperp.com, or follow me on any of my socials at alsoperp, A-L-S-O-P-U-R-P, then you have seen that I have just announced our upcoming slate of episodes. And if you missed it, then I will give you two previews. I will be joined by the one and only Connor Goldsmith, making his official debut on the feed, to talk all about Lana Del Rey's Ultraviolence. And I will also be joined by the one and the only Sarah Sentry for a deep dive into Agatha All Along. Those are due to be recorded in the next couple of weeks, so you have some time to send in some questions to referentialpodcast@gmail.com. Coming to your ears at some point next month in celebration of the 1-year anniversary of Referential. But that is it from me for now. Please send some love to our guest host today, and I will see you back here hopefully sooner than expected. Until then, be good, and if anything in this episode made you laugh or smile or think, then please leave me a 5-star rating and review. Thank you. Okay.
Good night.